It's interesting because when people ask about discipline, usually we're thinking of punishment. So usually that's the word or the definition that's really in a person's mind when they ask that. But really, discipline, the root of the word is to teach. And so really, we have to think about what are we trying to teach a small child or a toddler during this time. We don't want to teach them that like standing in the corner or getting a spank is the way to get what we want, because that's not a lifelong skill that they can carry into the future.
Hi, I'm Sarah Kuhn. Welcome to the Juno Women Podcast, where I sit down for candid conversations with women who are experts in their field and share their specific knowledge so that we can become better equipped to handle all things motherhood. Juno Women is an extension of Juna, a fitness and nutrition app created to help guide you through your trying to conceive, pregnancy, and motherhood journey. Everything we do at Juna is designed to empower and support you through one of the most incredible and challenging times of your life. Today, I'm talking to Michelle Asserby, a behavioral health specialist who works with parents of children ages 0 to 5. Michelle specializes in teaching parents how to read their child's cues and respond to their children in a way that enhances the relationship, supports their needs, and builds healthy brain architecture for future learning, security, happiness, and success. I hope you enjoy. Michelle, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I'm so excited to have you.
I'm super excited to be here.
Why don't you start by giving us a little bit of background, like introduce yourself and give us a little background about you.
Yeah, my name's Michelle. I've been working in community behavioral health for about 8 years now. I specifically focus on the birth to five population. I got my master's in infant family practice from Arizona State University back in 2015. So I've been specialized in specifically birth to five since then. Community behavioral health, I work a lot with foster families, so a lot of kind of trauma cases and whatnot. So I work to provide psychoeducation to parents to increase their understanding of attachment, trauma, development, and really anything that goes along with birth to five. So that is, I've always worked with the parents. I don't work directly with children. And that's actually where we see the greatest change. And that's why I do the work that I do.
Oh, that's so fascinating. Now that I think about it, if parents can change the way that they're parenting, then those effects you'll see trickle-down effects.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because people do visualize that you can send a 2 or a 3-year-old to therapy and they're going to lean back on a couch and have some therapy done. But really, I have had cases with immense progress where I didn't even meet the child. I only worked with the parent. It's all about the parent in birth to five, especially.
Yeah. So let's dive in, because you mentioned you specialize in attachment.
Yeah, it's one of my specialties. Okay. Definitely.
So why don't you describe what it means to you, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, so there's definitely a lot of mixed messages out there, so it's good to go in and explain it before we talk about it, because there's attachment parenting that kind of has come into society recently and has been practiced a lot. And then we also throw around the word attachment, like, oh, they're so attached to their stuffed animal or to their dog. But when I'm talking about attachment, it is a deep biologically, I guess, encouraged mechanism. So it's already in the body, it's already in the brain, the baby is ready for it. It is something that has been studied for decades. There's research to back it up. And so attachment is 100% necessary to a child's survival. If a child doesn't have an attachment figure, they do not survive. So there's actually really no such thing as not attached. So of course, there's varying qualities in the attachment, because we do have situations where unfortunately there's abuse or neglect and whatnot. And obviously that's not a secure and quality attachment, but there's still a figure there that sometimes is providing for basic needs enough to keep that child alive. So attachment to me is everything. It has shown to predict life success and contributes to learning. It helps with self-esteem. It helps with future relationships. So if you have attachment security, then you have everything, really.
Okay. And so let's like use the first like 3 months of a baby's life. How do you set up your baby with the best success for attachment, or for a very secure attachment?
Yeah, attachment is actually, we see the discriminant attachment stage at between 7 to 9 months. And anytime I give a time frame, it's give or take a few months. And so that is when the baby really has learned, this is my person, or these are my people. these are the one people that take care of me and that I can trust. So if we're talking about before that range, we're looking for that consistency and kind of that rhythm. Harvard University refers to it also as serve and return interaction. So baby is serving by cooing or turning towards you or screaming for you, crying for you, and you are reciprocating that. You are tending to them, you're being responsive. And so that's that serve and that turn, serve and return, like a tennis match back and forth. And so that is building that trust, and it's building those expectations and that predictability. And then when the baby gets to about 7 to 9 months, they start to learn, okay, we've been doing this dance for a while. We've been playing tennis for a while. I can trust that this is the person that I can go to.
Got it. Is it at all related to the fact that like around 7 to 9 months is also when our babies like get a little bit like they get stranger danger and they're a little bit literally more, I guess I'm going to use the word attached, but I know that's like when my babies have been aware that they don't want to go to anybody else.
Yeah. So we see separation anxiety and separation protest. And that is something we definitely want to see, even though it can be really difficult, because some babies have it to the point where a parent can't even leave the room at all for 1 second. Mm-hmm. And really that is them recognizing you are their person. And without you, they know that they can't survive. And so it's a threat to their survival when their parent is going away from them. And obviously parents need to go to the bathroom and shower and make lunch. And that's not saying you have to be on them 24/7, but that is why they're showing that protest at that time.
Got it. And curious, for kids that it's harder for a parent to leave the room, is that a representation of the type of attachment that's already been developed, or is that just a personality?
There's so much that goes into play. So there are environmental factors. So if there's extra stress in the home, the baby can pick up on that. So they may be more sensitive to their caregiver leaving them. That could be stress, whether there were big changes or there's even just stress within one of the parental figures in the home. There are temperament factors. So just depending on if they have a more easygoing temperament or a little bit more struggles in that area of adjusting to change. And so it's not really indicative of, oh, you have a really great attachment if your baby can't leave you, or you have a bad attachment if your baby can't leave you for 1 minute. There's just right. So much that goes into it.
Okay. Got it. I forget what podcast I was listening to. I want to say it was something with Oprah, but it must have been, but it was you mentioned stress in the home, and I had no idea that babies can pick up on, like, newborn infants. I think she had mentioned that it's like the first like 16 weeks of an infant's life, they pick up more stress in the family if there's stress between partners or fighting, that like parents think that it's okay to fight in front of a baby because they can't, but they feel it and then they like internalize it.
Absolutely. And really, so for a baby, they don't have a concept of a person being dangerous. If someone walked by with a weapon, they wouldn't know that person could harm someone. The only way that they sense danger is through their caregiver. So they hear your heart rate, their breathing change. They can hear the tone of voice changing and whatnot. And the responsiveness changes when they're stressed. Sometimes we're more responsive and overly responsive when we're stressed, or sometimes we take a step back because we aren't able to manage it. So they pick up on all of those things. So a threat to their caregiver is a direct threat to themselves. That's how they view it.
Got it. And so they're picking up on that stress, even if it's not like an actual threat. But yeah, that's interesting. Now, you bring up responsiveness. How does responsiveness play into attachment?
So responsiveness is really key. But when I talk about this, I have to always give disclaimers, because I think sometimes when we talk about responsiveness, people think, oh my gosh, I have to attend to every single cue or my baby is not going to have a secure attachment. But that is not real life. That expectation is not realistic. And if anything, that's going to stress a parent out more and prevent them from being optimally responsive. So really, you want to respond when you can. You don't want to intentionally ignore. So if you are available, your hands are available, you're emotionally available, you can pick your baby up, you definitely want to do that, because they're calling out for a reason. Again, there's that biology at play, those structures in the brain that I put out a signal and hopefully someone that keeps me safe responds. And so really by responding, we're conveying that sense of safety. Again, because the infant knows that they can't protect themselves from danger. So anytime they feel discomfort, they're hungry or they're scared or whatever else is going going on, they need that caregiver to bring them back down to a level of safety. They cannot do that on their own. And that's why responsiveness is important to attachment security, because you can't feel secure if you're not.
I think about the amount of times I've had to pick up and put down my now 1-year-old. And I'm like, and if I think about it, I'm like, you literally, you're diving out of my arms. And yet the moment I put you down, you want to be back up. Mm-hmm. And they do a really good job of kind of forcing responsiveness. I will say it is a fascinating how ingrained it is in them.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because there's so much going on with development, especially as we get into toddlerhood and whatnot. And so there are some of those push and pull interactions, like, I want this, wait, I don't want this. And again, that's also developmentally normal, because eventually that infant goes from seeing themselves as really a part of you. And then they start to see, okay, wait, I'm actually a separate person. I have different desires and wishes, and I have different plans than maybe my parent has for me. And so then we start to see some of that push and pull, because they absolutely still need you. They need to be near you, but then they also want to go do what they want to do. And so they are reconciling those two urges at the same time.
And when does that typically happen?
So I would say really that's why the terrible twos are called what they are. I don't like obviously using that phrase, but that's where that comes from, because around 2 to 3 is when we start seeing them exhibit those behaviors. And again, it's give or take. It could be earlier for some kids. It can be later for some kids. I would say around 3 is probably the average that we would see that. But yeah.
Okay. Huh. I'm thinking about my daughter who's about to be 3, and she's definitely going through some stuff right now.
Yeah. And there's a really great book by Alicia Lieberman, The Emotional Life of the Toddler. And she actually talks about how the separation anxiety peaks, obviously at 7 to 9 months, like we just discussed. And then it goes down around 1 year old, because that's when a child is really focused on being mobile. So they're walking and they're exploring that independence. But then again, between 18 months to 3 years, they again are like, okay, I got that developmental stuff down, but I still need you. And I'm going through a lot and I don't know how to manage it. So that's where we see the kind of back and forth in the peaks and valleys with separation protest and whatnot.
Got it. And so I want to talk about that, like toddler behavior and attachment and being responsive, but then and discipline and all of that. And how, what's like the best method?
for discipline. So it's interesting, because when people ask about discipline, usually we're thinking of punishment. So usually that's the word or the definition that's really in a person's mind when they ask that. But really discipline, the root of the word is to teach. And so really we have to think about, what are we trying to teach a small child or a toddler during this time? We don't want to teach them that like standing in the corner or getting a spank is the way to get what we want, because that's not a lifelong skill that they can carry into the future. They can't spank their coworkers. They can't put their spouse in a timeout in the corner. So we have to really focus on, okay, less about punishment. What's a skill we can teach? So that's why in the attachment and infant mental health world, we talk a lot about co-regulation. So how do we teach a child to actually calm their body? So they can't do it on their own, especially before 5. So we have to do that teaching for them.
Tell us why they can't do that?
So their brain structures just aren't developed enough to be able to do that. And their stress response system is not in a place to be able to do that. Basically, they have to have the experience of that being done with the caregiver over and over again until their body learns that they have a threshold. Their body learns to adequately detect threats and stress. And then they also have those coping skills to recognize those bodily sensations and then take action to calm themselves back to a baseline.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you about the Juna app, the app that makes this podcast possible. Juna is the premier app for every stage of motherhood, with a 12-week trying to conceive plan and workouts, key nutrition information for every week of pregnancy and postpartum, plus 6 full video courses on birth prep, breastfeeding, newborn care, infant sleep, sleep from 4 to 12 months, and starting solids. The app is designed to be your number one companion from trying to conceive through your baby's first year of life. It also includes daily diaphragmatic breathing exercises, pelvic floor prep, daily tips, and notes from me that are relevant to the exact things you are experiencing. These are so helpful for easing any fears and preventing the dreaded gestational Google mania, that sickness where you can't stop Googling every little thing that happens during pregnancy. Juna is available for both iOS and Android. Just search Juna in the App Store or go to juna.co. Again, that's juna.co. The app is completely free to try for 7 days, and if you decide it's not right for you, you can cancel anytime within the first week, no questions asked. Download Juna today and get started. Now, back to the show.
Now, if let's say that 30 years ago, when parents didn't sit with you through a tantrum and they just said, go to your room, or they hit you or whatever it was, those kids that didn't learn how to regulate their emotions, like what happens? Is it a skill that they have to learn later? Are they the kids that are just bullied? What happens? What's the consequence?
Yeah, I can even personally speak because like I grew up in the 90s. So I, mm-hmm. of course, got timeouts and spankings and whatnot. And even today, with everything I know, with my degree and my experience, it is really hard to express emotions to others, especially when we're having an emotional moment as a child and we're sent away. We're sent to timeout. Yeah. We're sent to lock ourselves in our room. Many adults still find themselves pulling away when they're having heightened emotions and having difficulties sharing that with friends or partners, feeling like they're a burden or not even knowing how to connect to that and articulate that. So it can have lifelong effects, and the degree of the effects are different for everyone, obviously.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think like I've always been like a stuffer of emotion, and I wonder like where that began, right? Like it is fascinating. And I wonder if like our generation of children who, cause obviously we know now a lot more than we did 30 years ago. And if they're going to be like way more in touch with their emotions. But then I'm also, and this is will lead me to my next question is like, how much of will this relate to, like, do all these kids like have so much anxiety? And like, how is anxiety so much more prevalent now if we're trying to be way more in touch and responsive and attached to our kids?
Yeah. And so do you mean like kids as far as like Gen Z today, like having anxiety, or do you mean like small kids as of now?
I feel like small kids like have anxiety, and or maybe we're just labeling it anxiety.
Yeah, I think that we're just recognizing really what is going on more. And when I say anxiety with like little kids, I usually talk about it like developmentally, like they're activated because they know there's an impending stress or there's a separation. But as far as like clinical anxiety, that obviously usually gets diagnosed later. But I think it's just our awareness of mental health. I think in the past, if a kid was having a hard time, it was like be seen and not heard, kind of stuff it down, go to your room if you can't, and then come back out when you're doing okay. And so now we're allowing space for that. So I don't think it's more. I think we're just seeing it and accepting it more.
Got it. And yeah, I think about like therapy for young kids when I was a kid was only for someone who experienced like severe trauma, not for someone who's just having a hard time. Whereas now therapy is fantastic for anybody.
Yeah. And especially like you said, it doesn't have to be a big event that happened. But if we have those patterns ingrained in us from being put in timeout and whatnot, and we don't know how to connect to our emotions and express them to our friends or our spouse or our family, then we might just go to therapy to learn some of those things that maybe we missed out on in early childhood.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So getting back to, we digressed. Getting back to toddler behavior and how to, I guess, lean in and connect with your kid when they're having a hard time.
Yeah. So co-regulation. So what that's about is teaching them and their brain, their body, that you can encounter a stressor. You can then calm down and I'm going to be there with you. And I'm going to do this so many times that eventually you're going to have this skill. And with this, there's a lot of fear. If I do this, am I rescuing my child? If I do this for them, they're never going to be able to do it on their own. But that's just not how it works. I think of it like if I just told someone, hey, you need to learn to salsa dance right now. And because I told you, you have to learn. And I'm not going to help you. And you've never been salsa dancing before. You've never even seen someone salsa dance. How are you going to do that? That is impossible. So why do we expect little ones to learn skills without being exposed to them, without being walked through those skills by someone who already has them mastered?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, this must be harder for someone who didn't like who did not have that experience growing up or no? Like,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's harder. And again, it's not guaranteed. It's not if you had an insecure attachment in childhood, you're forever doomed. And if you have a secure attachment in childhood, it's not like you're forever okay. There are obviously things that can come up. But if you didn't get the blueprint, like you didn't get the instructions to deal with these things and instructions and that experience of a parent doing it with you and helping you through it, then you don't have those skills to do it with your kid a lot of the time. And so there has to be a lot of reparenting done. Wow, when my kid throws something at me, I would have been spanked and I have this urge to spank them because that's what I know. But I know that I want to do differently. I know that experience didn't help me. And so there's a lot of reflection and awareness that has to be done on the parents' part so that they can then make the changes. And then that really will make a change for generations to come if they're able to do that with their own child.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You can like see that in a million different ways too.
Yeah, it's huge.
So how does this is a super touchy, but I'm just going to ask because I like how does attachment relate with sleep and sleep training?
Yeah. So yeah, it is really touchy. And with sleep training, it's so hard because I always trust that people are doing the best that they can with what they have and what they know at the time. And so the difficulties with sleep training is people aren't always getting all of the accurate information up front. And so they're making decisions with part of the information. So with attachment and sleep training, it again goes back to that responsiveness. And if we think about nighttime, that is the most vulnerable time of the day for not even just humans, but for animals, right? Like you can be attacked, like anything can happen. Your guard is down when you're sleeping. And so when a child is in a room in the dark and they experience some discomfort and they're calling out, and again, that sense of safety is not arriving, that's leaving them in a state of prolonged stress. And there's a lot of flawed studies that people will quote to say that, okay, well, they stopped crying, so they're okay. But really, it's all about conserving energy. We're not going to continue with maximum energy output if a stress isn't being neutralized. And so that's where we see the shutdown with babies. So just because they stop crying out because they're being ignored, that doesn't mean the stress has gone. It just means they're going into a kind of energy conservation mode there.
Got it. And so when there's all these different types of sleep teaching and sleep training and that range, the gambit, like what type of evidence is there, like, either way?
Yeah. So there's just the evidence in the research is really hard to pick through, which I actually usually when I get asked that, like on Instagram and with posts and whatnot, I actually stray away from focusing on that because some the studies are flawed. If you think of, a lot of it's based off of parent report. So if the baby stops crying, the parent may be feeling less stressed or like things are going awesome. Sleep training worked great. But is it great for that baby? We don't get a report from the baby. And then again, we can't really have controlled research done because it wouldn't really be ethical to purposefully subject certain babies to being ignored. And so I actually don't focus so much on the research and the evidence, but I like to focus on instincts. Like when a baby cries, a mother feels pulled to respond to their infant. That is just natural. Like I need to get there and I need to help them. Obviously there's instances where it could be just so stressed out that you can't in that exact moment, but naturally you feel like I need to pick them up. And so if there's any method that makes you change your natural response, I don't recommend that because there are methods where they're like, okay, you can pat your baby's back, but don't look them in the eye and don't pick them up. Or you can pick them up, but don't talk to them at all and don't look them in the eye. And again, like you're still modifying your natural human response. And that natural response is there for a reason. It's evolutionary. It has been fine-tuned and perfected across so many years. So any change to that to me is not going to be recommended or ideal.
Got it. And curious if how do I ask this? So I'm curious if there's been, are these kids that have not been responded to who've done sleep training, or do they have a heightened response to stress or?
So it's interesting because if they've learned to shut themselves down when they're experiencing stress, you might not actually see that external response. But if you test the cortisol levels of infants who weren't picked up at nighttime and whatnot, you will see that their cortisol levels actually didn't come down. And cortisol is the stress hormone. So they're seeing that still elevated. And so I think as they grow older, they may learn to be those kids that suppress. But if we looked at their insides, that might not be the case. There might be a lot of stress present in there. And again, that doesn't mean if you sleep train 1 week one time, or even if you did it for months one time, that you can't repair that. But there might be something that you need to repair if that was done.
Yeah. And so I guess your philosophy is always respond to your child's needs at night.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, there's situations, and it's hard to just say anything like black and white, because it's just parenting is so nuanced. It doesn't exist in black and white. But you have to keep in mind, if a parent is so stressed that they feel they may harm the baby or something, or they absolutely just cannot tend to the baby in that moment, that's okay if they need to step into the other room and take a break, because a stressed parent going in to help a baby is not going to help. But if you're finding yourself every night so stressed to the point where you can't respond, that's becoming a pattern. And I would say that parent would absolutely need support and help, because they shouldn't be feeling that way all the time. Well, that's terrible to feel that stress all the time. And then they're not able to tend to their baby's needs. So of course, there's an area where I would say it might not be the case where you can always do it. But if you're finding a problem in it, I would seek out support for sure.
This episode is sponsored by Element. Element is a really tasty electrolyte drink mix with everything that you need and nothing you don't. Guys, electrolytes are so important when you're pregnant, and with everything going on in your body, it's so easy for electrolyte deficiencies to occur. It's perfect for those who are nauseous in the first trimester and for those who are losing lots of sodium through sweating in their third trimester. It's also perfect for the nursing mama who's losing electrolytes through her breast milk. Element contains a science-backed electrolyte ratio, 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium. With none of the junk, no sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no fillers, no BS. I'm one of those people who sweats an obscene amount. Element has been getting me through all my postpartum workouts. I absolutely love this stuff and I can't recommend it enough. They have a variety of flavors. Raspberry ice is my favorite, but citrus brings me back to my athletic days of drinking sports drink, except Element has no added junk. I typically make a 32-ounce drink, and then I drink half, and then I fill it up again, and then I do this like 12 more times throughout the day so that I can make that flavor last as long as possible. You can try Element totally risk-free. If you don't like it, share it with a salty friend, and they'll give you your money back. No questions asked. As a member of our community, Element has a very special offer for you. You can get an Element sample pack for only covering the cost of shipping. Get yours here. drinklmnt.com/Juna. Once again, that's www.drinklmnt.com/Juna.
Yeah, I feel like that first 3 months, the sleep deprivation is so real. Mm-hmm. That by 4 and 5 months, you're just like, I don't think I can do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I guess that is like when your baby starts sleeping longer stretches too.
Yeah. At least
for hopefully.
Yeah.
Now, what about like later on? So like that with responding to your baby's needs in the middle, it's interesting. Like when I think about my own experience, like we did sleep training. So this is obviously an interesting conversation for me, but I have to say I would never, like I have a almost 5-year-old and almost 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. When my 3-year-old, if she were to call out in the middle of the night, I would never not go in.
Yeah.
Yet when my 7-month-old cried in the middle of the night, I'd like give it a minute to see if he would put himself back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's pretty normal and okay to wait a second, give it a minute, like you said. You don't have to jump on it every time, but extended crying, if it's going on for 5, 10, 20 minutes, that's where it could be hard for the little one.
Yeah, I'll never forget my son when he was 2, went through this like deep regression, and he was just an absolute, it was unbelievable like how many times we'd have to go back in. And a verbal kid is so different than just a crying baby, right? Like it's, and I think that's like why, like, oh, you like, I had a bad dream or I did this. And it's so interesting how different how differently you can respond, where like it's a visceral response when your baby's crying and you're like, I must go in. Mm-hmm. But when it's more of an empathetic response. Oh, you had a bad dream. I get it. Let me give you a cuddle.
Yeah. And that is what's really hard, is that babies obviously only have their cry to communicate. They can't say, I'm scared, or I feel sick, I'm going to throw up, or any of those things that we would see like an older toddler saying.
Right.
But it does help for a parent to put words to those cries, like you're really scared or you really need help right now. So labeling that, because it does mean something and it's really up to us to decipher it. And maybe that can help us attune better if we do end up labeling it on our end, so that we can just understand that there is a need there. It's not just a cry to cry or a cry to manipulate.
Totally, totally. Oh, Yemen, you just used a word.
I know. I did.
It's interesting. I don't think I've ever used the word manipulate with my kids, and probably consciously, because they're like uniquely designed to figure out a way to get what they need. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's easy to call that manipulative.
Yeah. And that it's still so prevalent today. And I go on rants about this on my Instagram, but it's, if we think about actual manipulation, that there is like intent there. There is intent to take advantage and be deceitful. And it kids' brains just are not capable of that at all, or else we would have 5-year-old politicians and we don't. Like, that's not possible. There's a difference between like developmental, like experiencing with or experimenting with cause and effect. Like, I do this and then this happens. That doesn't have ill intent. That's really them learning, and it's absolutely developmentally appropriate and necessary. So we have to draw the line there. Like, this isn't, they don't have an evil plan in the background where they want to drive you insane. It's more like, I'm just learning and I need help going along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about my daughter. Like, we call her the CEO because she's literally, she knows exactly what she wants and what she does not want, and is very good at making everyone follow her rule. And it's very impressive, but not manipulative. It's just, she knows what she wants. And
yeah,
very good qualities for the future Kyla, but very hard to parent.
Yeah, it is. And it really becomes any of the hard things in parenthood and early childhood end up becoming strengths later on. We just have to get through it and fine tune them. And then they'll be off to use them to, again, be CEOs and whatnot. Yeah.
So my last question is, do you have for anyone who's going like on the fence, they're like figuring out what type of parenting like tactics they're going to use, especially in like difficult moments, do you have any advice for them?
So really, I would say two things. A parent has to attune to themselves and what's going on, attune to themselves. So if they are stressed in that moment, their stress is really the top priority. And some people take a step back and look at me weird when I say that. But if you think about it, like, if you're not in control of your stress in that moment, how are you going to do that for your baby? And so that is the most important thing. And some parents will just continue pushing themselves to the edge, and they don't have support, and ignoring their mental health and their physical health and all of that. But really, if you're not healthy, you can't do that very well for your baby. So with anything that you're going to do, I would say that is the most important first step. Do not collect $200 and pass go if you have not done that yet. And the second thing I would say is, if you're in a place where you feel calm and connected to what's going on with you, then connecting to your child. So many strategies today focus on disconnection. So timeouts, ignoring, just having that connection broken. And I would say connection is what is built into us. It's in our instincts. And so if you feel that instinct in you, like, listen to that. And I say that, and there's some people who don't have that instinct, and so I have to also put a disclaimer there. If you don't feel that instinct, that might be something to explore. But connection is the way to go with any parenting method that we use.
Yeah, no, I love that. I have found that when I lean into my kids' troubles or whatever they are, they dissipate much quicker than when I don't. And it's always seems easier to just lean in and try and connect with them, because I'm like, this will definitely help all of us.
Yeah. And a lot of people worry about the time that takes. So I don't have 10 minutes to connect with my kid. I'm doing all of this. But if you added up every minute that you had to redirect your child, or if you're doing these other methods, like it would end up more time actually than if you just invested the 10 minutes in that moment. And so we're not saying you have to spend an hour every other hour with your kid totally focused on them, but just fill up their cup a little bit. Connect for 10 minutes if you know that you have to go do something for 30 minutes. Just being intentional with that connection time can help fill them up so that they can last until the next time that they need it again.
Totally, totally. I love that. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was super great, very informative, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to spread the word about this stuff, so I appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, thank you. Okay, that's all for today. If you liked today's episode, please share it with a mama friend and leave us a review. If you're pregnant, postpartum, or trying to conceive, you can download the Juna app completely free for 7 days. The app is available for iOS and Android and is designed to be your guide for all things health and fitness for this very special time of your life. If you have any suggestions for episodes you would like to hear or anyone you think would be a great guest on the show, please email me directly at sarah@juna.co. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.